For centuries, man has been on top of the food chain. Until now.
They're here! They're coming! God, no!
So you guys understand that we're dealing with a highly intelligent beast.
What is it about those little furry bodies that's so frightening?
Science has agreed that unless something is done and done quickly, man as the dominant species of life on Earth would be extinct within a year. Nature, mad, rampant.
Oh, no, not the beast! Not the beast! Ah! Oh, no, my eyes!
The next victim could be you.
I'm Cootie, and welcome to The Food Chain, the podcast where nature runs amok and mankind is the main course. With me, as always, is my lovely assistant, X.
I feel pretty, so hello, everybody.
Now, this show is all about eco-horror movies, you know, where nature has gone mad. So, in just about all of these kinds of movies, there's a reason why animals turn against mankind. Let's find out why strange things are happening on this episode as we spin the Wheel of Mutation.
Looks like our winner is Radioactive Waste!
Radioactive Waste! Radioactive! Radioactive Waste! Radioactive! Radioactive Waste! Radioactive! Radioactive Waste!
And another thing that happens in the genre of movies we're going to be covering on this show is that someone is always brought in from the outside to help solve the mystery of what's going on. Like, why are all the sheep dying? How come there are no birds singing? And why the fuck is there a gigantic bear sitting on my couch?
So we have also brought in a consultant to help us break down our movie this episode. He is an author, an editor, renowned for his additions to the Lovecraft mythos. He's the co-host of the ABCs of Hidden Horror podcast. He's a panelist on the Evil Episodes podcast. He's a critic, a ne'er-do-well, and a blackguard. His wife's pretty cool, too. Please welcome Brian Sammons to the food chain. Did I miss anything?
A swell guy who loves pets.
Aww.
Well, God knows I have enough of them. Hi, everybody, and hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, we're glad you
could make it. Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So, since we've already spun the Wheel of Mutation and learned that the real villain in this film is radioactivity, let's go ahead and listen to the trailer for this episode's Unnatural Horror.
I tell you, gentlemen, science has agreed that unless something is done and done quickly, man as the dominant species of life on Earth would be extinct within a year. States, stay in your homes. I repeat, stay in your homes. Your personal safety, the safety of the entire city, depends upon your full cooperation with the military authorities.
Yes, cities, nations, even civilization itself, threatened with annihilation, because in one moment of history-making violence, nature, mad, rampant, wrought its most awesome creation. For born in that swirling inferno of radioactive dust, were things so horrible, so terrifying, so hideous, there is no word to describe them.
witnesses to a biblical prophecy come true, and there shall be destruction and darkness come upon creation, and the beast shall reign over the earth.
Yes, the earth, the skies above and the seas below, infested by swarms of nightmare creatures, crueler, deadlier than the armored giants of prehistoric eras. Here is a wild, headlong flight into terror, as the desert erupts with the grim battle for survival. Here is a fear-frenzied moment of suspense, as mankind totters before a thing that multiplies faster than it can be killed. Here is a desperate plunge into the black depths of the earth, where human courage challenges the brute force, the slashing jaws, the poison fangs that guard the subterranean nest where the beast spawns its terrible progeny.
To all units. To all units. Condition red. Drain 267 is the target area. Repeat. Condition red. Drain 267 is the target area.
We can't take a chance. It might poison the whole city.
From 1954, giant radioactive ants threaten an area from New Mexico to Los Angeles.
We'll be right back to talk about them after this break.
In a world gone mad.
As you know, the Doomsday Clock is a symbolic clock face analogizing humankind's proximity to extinction.
One man must fight to survive on the global junk heap of the future.
You maniacs! You blew it up! Damn you! God damn you all to hell!
Which versus the Doomsday Clock is that man's story? His search for entertainment is transmitted across time and space for your listening pleasure on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and your Android device.
This podcast is not fit for human consumption. Side effects include laughter, concern, nausea, vomiting, and blame for moral purposes. The producers accept no responsibility for any side effects, illness, or internet brain mind calls. My bank guarantee is worth nothing. Zero, zero, zilch, nada, overall, no sausage. In short, you get nothing. Nothing. Good day, sir.
Thanks for hanging out. We're back. You know, Brian, the reason that we brought you on this specific episode as our consultant was a Facebook interaction where it seemed like someone was about to say something disparaging about them, the movie Them, not personal pronoun Them. But and you instantly jumped to that movie's defense, and I was impressed.
Oh, well, thank you. I am a sucker for big bug movies. They are all various shades of good in my book, but this is one of the best. It's also one of the first, and as a kid, I was a big old wussy. it was bad. The idea of being scared me. So I would avoid horror films like The Plague. Whenever my friends would, hey, let's watch such and such, I'd be, oh, look at the time, gotta go, my mom's calling, bye. And then one day I was forced into it, and the rest is history. It completely changed my life. But even back in my scaredy cat days, I would love the old creature double feature. They would show it on one of the UHF stations. It would be two old quote-unquote horror movies. They were never very scary. They were mostly stuff from like the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And big bug movies, and specifically this movie here, it was on constant rotation. So I can't tell you the number of times I've seen this film. And I've always loved it. As a, you know, little terrified child, all the way up to the miscreant I am today.
That's awesome.
I first heard about this movie from my dad, who saw it when it came out in the theater, and he said the thing that always stuck with him was the noise that,
yes,
that the ants make. Now, watching it again just for this show, I was like, these ants, I think a belt slipping because they sound like a steering pump gone bad. But It's interesting. I'm going to Wikipedia here, which is probably not the most reliable source, but apparently the noise for the ants was created by combining some other animal sounds. It's a bird-voiced tree frog mixed in with the calls of a wood thrush, a hooded warbler, and a red-bellied woodpecker.
Wow. What? That sounds like something you would mash up.
I don't know who came up with those specific birds, but that's interesting. So if you're ever, I guess, in the jungle and you hear that noise, it's not big ants, it's just four.
That specific combination of five birds.
That's right.
One thing I always thought what had to be in a mix, and I guess it's not, but cicadas. It has almost that rhythmic, that scree, 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 scree sound that I associate with them.
Yeah.
I get that, yeah.
Yeah, I guess they saved that for the Beast Within. So anyway, the thing that sucks me in about this movie, and I really, it starts off as a basic police procedural. And that's really interesting. You don't get too much of a hint that anything is wrong or, you know, it's just like, oh, we're looking for this guy in a trailer and here's this girl walking through the desert. She's like, what is she, 8, 7 or 8 years
old? I think she's younger than that. She's like 5 or 6 maybe.
Yeah, just walking through the desert and the cops are like, we should probably pick her up. And so they do. And then they find the trailer where she was living with her folks and it's been destroyed. The wall's been, that's been pushed and it's been pulled out. And really all they can find is some sugar. And that's weird. I mean, if you don't know what the movie's about going into it, that's just a strange thing. But that kid looks genuinely terrified the entire time.
Yeah, she does catatonic, like, really fucking well.
Which I didn't even know that was a skill until I saw this movie. I also think it's funny that the cops are like, well, we should just hold on to the kid till we go find the trailer. No sense in taking her to the hospital or anything or getting her proper treatment until we can find her family. Like, really?
It was the 50s. Kids were tougher back then.
She's fine. It's fine. She'll take a nap. It's fine.
You just pick her up, dust her off, give her a shot of whiskey, and send her on her way.
That's what my mama always did.
Exactly.
Give her a hoop to roll down the sidewalk. She'll be great.
I love how earnest it's played and how serious. In later Big Bug movies, there would usually be some sort of comic relief, and usually it would be some dopey deputy or something like that. Mm-hmm. But here, you're very much right. It's just two cops on patrol finding this lost kid. And nobody is mugging for the camera. Nobody's, well, golly gee, what could be happening? Or any of that stupid stuff that would eventually evolve into some of the other films.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, James Whitmore, who plays the main cop in this movie, his partner rarely says more than two words. We were laughing about that. He just went, uh-huh, yep.
Uh-huh, yep.
All right. Okay, that's it. Just monosyllabic. Tough cop.
Mm-hmm. Very serious.
So, okay, so they got the girl, and the ambulance finally comes. They load her up into it, and they hear this weird noise in the distance, and the girl just sits up, just Michael Myers.
Just
whoomp.
Wide-eyed and terrified.
And when the sound dies down, she lays back down. She's not fine, but at least she's, you know, she's not sitting straight up. And the cops just go, oh, that's the wind. The wind is strange out here.
Very, you know, rhythmic wind.
Yeah. There ain't no fog bank out there.
I spent a week fucking camping in a canyon in the desert. The wind does not sound like that.
I would hope not. That would cut down on tourism.
Right?
Okay, so the next weird thing that happens is they go to basically just like a corner store, a general store.
Yeah.
And they're going to go see Gramps. Gramps Johnson runs the store. They're going to get a egg cream and a Cornetto. The store's all screwed up, just like the trailer was. The wall's been pulled out, and nobody's taken any money. And again, the sugar supply has been broken into. And they find Gramps dead in the cellar. And he looks, well, he's dead. He's not going to look great, but it's kind of gruesome looking at him in black and white.
It is, yeah. And I wonder, at that time, I mean, when did you say this movie was made? Like 52, 53?
54.
54, okay, I was close.
You would have got
that. I mean, yeah. I just wonder, I mean, you know, it's kind of graphic for that period.
when they get the coroner's report back, and this is interesting, they say that Gramps died of a broken neck, broken back, a skull fracture, a crushed abdomen, and a broken heart. And there's also enough formic acid in his body to kill 20 men. So I did a little research on formic acid, because what do I know about that stuff? Formic acid occurs naturally in nature, and it does occur naturally in ants. And it's also the irritating agent in stinging nettles.
Oh, wow.
So if you've ever
at you breaking that out.
Right? So if you've ever, like, you know, had nettles stuck to your leg and were like, wow, that hurts, that's formic acid. That's like getting bitten or stung, I guess is correct, by an ant.
I don't know if I've ever had a nettle stuck to my leg.
It doesn't seem, you know, you can make tea out of them. It doesn't seem like that's such a bad thing, but I don't know.
Maybe I know what ants smell like. I don't want to drink tea that smells like ants.
I have never noticed an ant smell.
Me neither. And it's funny, when we were watching this film, Jamie said the same thing. She's like, that's why ants smell. And I'm like, I've never smelt an ant. She's like, you never smashed an ant and smelled it? I'm like, well, not on purpose.
Oh, wow. No, I
wasn't
like
that creepy of a kid, I guess.
Yeah, no, totally. I used to, well, you know, I grew up out in the country, and ants are just a fact of life out there, and they would get in the kitchen every summer, and I hated them, and so I made a game out of, like, squishing them. In fact, when I was cooking dinner, I used to, like, pick them up and drop them on top of the hot lid that was on the pot, and this is horrible. I can't believe I'm confessing this on a podcast, but because I hated them so much. But yeah, after a while, like, after you've killed so many ants, your hands just smell like, it's a very distinct smell. It's ant smell. I guess it's the formic acid. I don't know.
Okay, thank you for because that was like the weirdest conversation I've had in a long time about ant smell.
Sorry. No. The more you know.
Right. The more ants you kill, the more they stink. You heard it here first. So, of course, the outsider, the consultant, the FBI, sends a special agent in to help investigate, and the cops have taken a plaster cast of a print that they found at the crime scene. Of course, they have no way of knowing that it's a gigantic ant print, but that's that's what it is. But the Department of Agriculture sends our comic relief, the old Dr. Medford, and his hot daughter, Pat, and they are... Here's another great word. They are myrmecologists. So myrmecologists, of course, are ant experts.
Are they comic relief?
I think the doctor is, don't you?
He has a few good one-liners. I don't know if he falls into the comic relief category. I mean, he's not bumbling. His every action isn't played for laughs. But he can, you know, unleash a zinger or two.
He has a hard time with the goggles when you first meet him. So he seems
why I liked him better than any other character in the movie.
Yeah.
He also has that bit with the radio where they keep telling him, you got to say over. I did say over. Well, you got to say over again.
Right.
It's
right.
A rule. Yeah, so it's interesting. Yeah, so he is kind of the only comic relief in the film, and he's also the one who ends up, oh, this is a biblical prophecy and we're all doomed. So kind of like a wacky doomsayer sort of character. It's interesting.
Well, he is also Santa Claus.
That's true. That's very true.
It's Edmund Gwynn from A Miracle on 34th Street.
Oh, I was wondering where that came from. I haven't seen A Miracle on 34th Street. I don't want to. I don't really care. But
it's okay. You believe in ants.
I do, and they stink.
And your hatred for them.
It's just showing through. So the little girl, we go back to her, she's catatonic, and instead of giving her smelling salts or something to try to arouse her from that state, old Dr. Medford waves a glass of formic acid under her nose.
And it works.
It works. I don't know where he got that much formic acid. I mean, do they keep that in hospitals?
I think he just carries it along with him.
Just like a flask.
He does. He's a scientist.
You never know when it's going to come in handy.
That's true. And it did in this situation, because it woke the girl from her catatonic state, and she starts screaming, them, them! And then she goes and hides next to a dresser, and the nurses pick her up and try to coddle her. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, them, like... It's such a generic title for this movie. Like, why not big fucking ants? No, it's them with an exclamation point even.
It is weird that she would choose that as like the only word she says, you know. Yeah. I mean, shouldn't it be those?
I don't know.
I guess when you're six, it doesn't matter. Anyway, they go back out to the campsite where the kid was. The trailer's there. And Pat, such a great shot! Pat's doing something, and up over the ridge comes this gigantic 8-foot-long ant with its... the mandibles are furry and weird, and it's just waving its mandibles back and forth, and the antenna just flailing. Antenna, where am I from?
Antenna.
Them antennas just flailing away. So it's our first real ant attack that we get to see.
And it's awesome.
And I love it so much, especially when you think that somebody had to build that thing.
That's one of my questions. How many ants did they have to build for this movie?
I think the most you ever see at once are four. So they could have just reused the same four. Later on, spoiler, you see some dead ants lying around. So I think they just repurposed them over and over again. But the most I ever see on screen moving around was four. So that's a lot of building right there, because these ants, I mean, they're like Volkswagens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're fully articulated, and they keep getting set on fire, too. Except in this first scene. The first scene is great because the FBI agent's got, like, this little, like, snub-nosed .38, and he's trying to shoot the antennae off of the ants. And I don't know why the federal agent's got the .38, but the local cop has a Tommy gun.
Yeah, I thought that was, I mean... How often do they need to break out submachine guns in Nowhereville, USA?
Apparently there's some rough streets in Alamogordo that they need to patrol. Anyway, okay, so boom, there's that ant. He's done. But that pretty much confirms Dr. Medford's theory that, hey, you're dealing with really, really big ants, and they've been mutated by the radiation from the first atomic bomb tests out in White Sands, Alamogordo, New Mexico. So that's the whole setup for this. And I'm thinking that at the time this came out, because when were those atomic tests? 40s, right?
Yeah, 44, 45.
Yeah. So this is still...
It's been about 10 years, almost 10 years.
Right. Which is probably just enough time, especially after the end of World War II, for people to really kind of not be cool with the fact that radiation exists.
Well, yeah, it took them a little while to realize just what radiation was, because at first they really didn't know. I mean, there was all these wild theories. I mean, there was serious scientific thought behind the theory that just letting off one bomb could destroy the world. It could ignite the atmosphere, and suddenly no atmosphere, no air, we all die. But they went and did it anyways, because like, nah, that wouldn't happen, I hope.
America.
Yeah.
And even if it does, fuck Japan!
And you hear about all those early tests where, you know, they'd drop a bomb, and they're, okay, send some guys through. We just want to see how, you know, what happens. And they would, you know, send soldiers through unprotected.
Or just have them outside watching.
Y'all
just stand here. We're going to set something off. Y'all should take a look at this. Here's some shades. Don't burn your eyes out. Yeah, and then they just watched them to see what would happen. It's so
scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it took a little while for them to realize, hey, you know, these bombs are, they're great. They blow up real good, but they have a nasty, you know, aftertaste.
Yeah. There's some side effects going on here. Yeah, so I'm sure that when this came out, that really helped spur interest in the film, if not box office. I mean, this was a decent hit.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And it opened up the floodgates to all.
Oh, yeah.
As I said, there were 100 other big bug movies. Most of them dealt with radiation. There was big people movies, like giant movies.
The Amazing
Colossal. Those were radiation.
Yep.
Exactly. I mean, radiation was this uncorked genie that just went out of control, and, you know, who knows what it could do. That kind of thing.
Well, apparently it could do anything, because you had the Amazing Colossal Man and the Incredible Shrinking Man.
Yeah,
and both of those were radiation. So whatever you need, man. It was a perfect foil for science fiction at that time. So at this point, they've got the helicopters out. They're doing a helicopter search through the desert, and they find just
a giant hole.
A giant hole, and that's it's the ant nest. And right outside the ant nest are skeletal remains, skulls, bones. You see,
there's a great shot where an ant comes up out of the top of the hole, and he's holding a rib cage in his mandibles,
and then he spits it out.
Right?
Just doing a little housekeeping. I'll leave this here.
When I saw that just recently, I was like, well, at least they're very neat creatures.
They are.
Right? Yeah.
It's like the rabbit of Carabana tossing skulls out. Of course, you get to see the shot of the cop's former partner. His gun belt is lying there after he was eaten by the ants. I thought that was a nice touch. So, here's how they decide to go after the ants. And it's interesting, and it's elaborate. First of all,
they bomb all the sand around the opening to the ant hole.
To keep it hot, because ants don't like heat, which makes sense that they're in the fucking desert. So,
right.
Ants don't like heat. We'll keep the hill hot, and that will keep the ants underground in their nest. And in the meantime, they will throw cyanide bombs into the ant nest to kill all the ants, and then just seal it off. So it's kind of like a pressure cooker full of cyanide. And my thought the whole time was, why didn't they just poison some sugar? Just drop some.
That's a good idea.
Just drops. I mean, that's what they're after anyway, is the sugar. So
yeah.
I guess if they did that, that would take a lot longer, because now you got to eat the sugar, bring the sugar to other people, or ants, I guess. Have them eat it, you know. Whereas just cyanide gas is just going to fill the whole place up. It's an expedient method.
I see. Yeah.
Last night when we were watching it, Cootie brought up the fact they should have just poured some molten aluminum into the nest.
I was like, we need like 125 tons of molten aluminum stat. Just helicopter that shit in.
Just make it an art piece.
Yes.
So anyway, ba-da-da, they're cyanide, it's fine, it's cleared out, it's all settled towards the bottom, so the cop, the FBI guy, and beautiful Pat strap on...
are going into the nest.
Yeah, they strap on gas masks and go down in there, and you know...
And they're bringing along a woman.
They are.
Oh.
Flamethrowers, guns, and a woman. Sounds like a Warren Zevon song. Now, what's interesting is as they go through the nest, they keep going down level by level, like sub-levels of the ant nest. Eventually, they get to the egg chamber. Now, did anyone else immediately think of Alien during this sequence?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. In fact, they are when they're going through the nest, somebody, I forget who, goes, huh, looks like these walls are held together by saliva. And I immediately said, yeah, but secreted from what?
Nice. And yeah, and then James Whitmore says, spit's all that's keeping me together, and we did not understand what he meant by that. So we just roll tight on that. Just let it go. It's fine. So yeah, Alien obviously really lifted almost wholesale that whole egg chamber sequence from this movie.
Well, but the xenomorphs are very ant-like anyway. And yeah. I mean, yeah, that's pretty obvious throughout all of those movies.
Yeah, by the time the second one came around, it's clear James Cameron had ants in mind when he told his take on the alien monster.
Mm-hmm.
What they realize when they're down there is that two of the eggs have hatched. And I don't know how they could tell just from the egg shell that was left over, but it's two queen ants, or I guess as they call them, princess ants. Because
yeah, I don't know either. I mean, like, are their eggs different from the other ones? Because that's kind of
maybe they're bigger. Was it two princesses? I thought, and I could be wrong, I thought it was a princess and then two winged males.
No, it was two princesses, definitely, and then they had their consorts with them.
Did one of the princesses land on a boat or something, and that kind of happened off screen?
Yes.
There was.
That's what I'm, okay, yes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting confused.
What happened was the boat kept this particular hatch open all the time, never closed it, and the princess ant landed inside of that hatch. And I guess they just never went to see what was in that hatch. So you get this great sequence of, you can see through like the frosted window of the telegraph room on the boat, people on the other side getting mandibled and kind of hauled off. And then the big ant comes crashing through and gets the guy who's trying to send the SOS message through Morse code. So they sunk the boat and took all the survivors onto another boat and did not let them go to shore. They're also trying to keep everything secret. So
well, there were no survivors, but they kept everybody on the like rescue mission ships out to sea so they could try to keep it a secret. Okay. Yeah.
That might be what I meant. I don't know. It probably wasn't. So at this, there's another, the next sequence is also interesting to me because they intercept kind of a, like a UPI wire report about a man who's in a psychiatric hospital because he was flying his plane over Texas and he swore that he saw flying saucers in the shape of ants.
As you do.
Like you do.
But now this pulls in the whole UFO craze from the 50s, too. And that's a really interesting kind of side addition to this movie, I think. It's almost like, you know, Kenneth Arnold had that book, Flying Saucers Are Real, and he saw this while he was flying his airplane. And they've kind of taken that and distilled it down into this character, what was his name, Crotty? It was some weird name.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah, and he was played by Fess Parker, who later became Daniel Boone on TV.
Oh, shit.
Good call, yeah.
That's where I know him from. Yeah. It was bugging me while we were watching it.
So anyway, he tells his story to the FBI guy and beautiful Pat, and he's like, Do you believe me? I swear it actually happened. And they were like, we believe you, sir. He's like, great, get me out of here. I want my clothes, and I'm sorry I hit that truck, but it was an old truck. So hell with it, and, you know. And when they talk to the doctor, the FBI guy's like, keep him here.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, usually around the 50s, the government guys were pure good guys. Because, you know, McCarthyism, we hate commies, USA, number one. So almost always the men from the government were always nice and noble and doing things for your best interest. Mm-hmm. Here they're like, nope, we got to lock this guy up. We may let him out later, but not right now.
I think the line is actually, we'll tell you when he's well.
Yeah. That's exactly what he said. We'll tell you when he's well. Like, fuck me. Really? And do you think they thought of this motherfucker once they were finished with all of this jazz? I bet they didn't.
Nope.
He died alone in that sanitarium.
Yes, he did. Poor fucker.
Oh, man. Okay, so now... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what kills me about this part of this movie, I mean, it's interesting, and, you know, all of the, like, strategic things that they go through, but every time that they do, like, a time check, where they're like, how long ago do you think this happened? Well, it was about 5 months ago, and you're like, fuck me, how long does this movie cover? Like, this is a huge time frame that this movie covers. And I'm like, how are you moving so slowly? These things could take over and destroy the entire planet, and it's been like 7 months since the first incident happened. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, but they don't have satellite photos or anything to work on.
I don't care. Ridiculous. It was driving me crazy.
Really, all they have to go on are the testimonies of people who could potentially be insane and the scenes of great sugar robberies.
And I love how they're tracking all this shit, too. Like, we didn't really touch on that, but they've basically taken over, like, half of a skyscraper, and they've got all of these offices filled with people who are doing nothing but looking for stories in, like, small local newspapers and listening in on shit, like, local news broadcasts, trying to like, glean information from all over the country as to where these ants could possibly be. So it makes sense that it would take that long, but it's just like, God damn, y'all.
But none of the government workers understand the full scope of the project.
Yeah, it's all hush up.
Yeah, they don't know what, everybody's got a piece of it, and nobody really understands the big picture. And I think that's interesting, too. I don't know if that still goes on today or not. I can't tell what the hell's going on with government right now.
I don't want
to. Yeah. Okay, so now we're coming kind of towards the crux of it. There's been a big, again, it sounds silly to say, but there's been a sugar theft in Los Angeles. And it was a train car. It was a train car that got ripped apart. And
big fucking shipment. What did they say, like 40 tons or something?
Yeah, something like that. So
now, ants like sugar and all that, but that's not like all they eat. They should have had, I mean, have a whole, I was going to say flock of cows, but that's not right. A herd. Have a whole herd of cows disappear or something.
Yeah. Cows, sheep, something.
I mean, it starts getting ridiculous where everywhere you go, there's grains of sugar all over the place.
I agree. Yeah. They could have at least stripped a tree.
Yeah. I mean, something. Yeah, a whole forest gone.
Yeah, shit. You
know, that would make people notice.
I bet those ants are here. So this is one of my favorite sequences. They learn about this, well, he's a classic 50s town drunk sort of character, and he's in the hospital, and he claims to have seen the giant ants. And he says that he will tell them what he knows about the ants if they recruit him and make him General of the Booze. Tell me, what does it mean to be the General of the Booze?
General of the Booze. And he sings a song about it. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And then you have the one guy next to him. And I was wondering, is that a cameo? If I was in the 50s, would I know who that is? Because they focus on his face and they hold it for so long. And he's like, please, my nerves.
Oh, you looked like Lon Chaney Jr.
Maybe. I mean, I didn't recognize him, but I'm like, why is the camera still on him? Is that somebody's uncle?
Probably. It's the producer's father.
Something, yeah.
Anyway, Drucky Boy tells them that he sees the ants going in and out of the drains in the Los Angeles riverbed, which is famously dry. And these are the same kind of concrete area where you've seen 100 different car chases or car races in different movies.
Greece.
Yeah, Greece. The Greece lightning race at the end of Greece. It's in the Gumball Rally, I know for sure.
Oddly enough, a movie we had watched just the night before, Return to Living Dead Part 3. God knows why we watched that again. But that takes place in the LA River. At least the ending does. In the various sewers and tunnels they're in.
Oh, wow.
That's interesting.
So we're like, oh, wow, a double feature.
I think I missed part 3.
You didn't miss much.
Okay. That's the one with Mindy Clark, right? That just never looked interesting to me. So,
yeah, the best thing about it is a cute girl goes all... I mean, this was before goth was goth, and he sticks various sharp implements all over her body. Special effects are kind of okay, but the story, the acting, the directing, pretty much everything right down the line just is subpar.
Is that a Yesna joint?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
He actually directed it, too.
Wow. All right.
So, the best thing he ever did was give Stuart Gordon money to make movies.
Yes. That's the truth. All right, we're coming down to the end of it now. The climactic third act, which is actually really tense.
Yeah.
This poor woman, it's like her father took her... Not her father.
No, her husband.
Her husband took their kids out to, like, go fly a model airplane just to get out of the house and do something. Well, father's dead. He's mutilated, and nobody can find the kids. And they were flying the plane right there in the L.A. riverbeds. So they're like, okay, well, this is awesome, because now we have two kids who are missing, and we think the ants are in there, too. So the military and our main cop guy, they all start getting in jeeps and driving through different portions of the sewer system, and it's well done. They keep cutting back to the mother of the kids, and she's, you know, fretting the more news that she gets. Really well done, really tense. So anyway, yeah, there's martial law in Los Angeles, there's a nest underneath the city, and James Whitmore, our main cop dude, finds the kids, but they're being threatened, really. I don't know if that's the word, because they really can't get to the kids because they're, like, too big to fit into the little cubbyhole that they're in. I think they're harassed by the ants.
Well, they're trapped.
Maybe.
Yeah, yeah. They're blockaded, they're trapped, and the kids are freaking the fuck out. And rightly so, because, you know, they're two little bits. But I love the way he describes this part when he goes into the tunnel and he sees that the kids are there, and he gets on the radio and he's like, it's got the brood smell, just like back in New Mexico. And I'm just like, oh, the brood smell. And you can almost smell what that must be like just from that description.
No, you can. Brian and I can't, because we don't know what the hell you're talking about.
All right, fine.
I guess you should just wave a glass of formic acid under my nose until I finally understand.
You're going to.
I'm going to?
I will educate you on this. You just wait.
So anyway, Whitmore finds the boys. They're, like I said, they're backed up. He can't use his flamethrower because he will roast the children. So calls in the troops. He kind of repositions himself so he can blast the ants with petrol. And he gets the boys up into the sewer pipe, and he just is like, crawl, 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 get the hell out of here, and go to your mother. So he saves the kids. Meanwhile, an ant sneaks up behind. How the fuck does something that big sneak up behind you? Anyway, it sneaks up behind
him. And that damn constantly noisy screeching, but whatever.
Yeah, so anyway, he gets mandibled.
He dies.
Yeah, he just kind of gets, it's like a bear hug from
an, it is,
from an ant.
From giant pinchers.
Yeah, it just kind of ragdolls him back and forth for a while and then throws him. So
I guess in the 50s, they couldn't show him getting bisected.
Yeah, I guess not. Anyway, I'll return to that in a moment because I want to touch on that. So we have dead cop. Anyway, we still have cool FBI guy and the myrmecologist's daughter. That sounds like a Victorian porn.
I declare.
I don't know. That's Southern for some reason.
Hey, that wasn't too bad.
Well, thank you.
Southern England.
Oh, boy.
So we're down to the final ants, and the troops come in, and they've got guns, and they've got flamethrowers, and the old doctor is there, and they find four ants that are, they still have their, it's the queen, and the other ants still have wings, and they were getting ready to fly out of the sewer system and keep, you know, forming more colonies in other cities with, I guess, large dry riverbeds that have been covered with concrete. But the doctor, the old doctor, says, I am convinced that these are the final ants. I am positive that no other ants have flown out of this sewer system.
Well, he is an expert.
Yeah, I started to say, hooray for experts.
I don't know, that just made, I was like, how are you sure? You didn't do like a head count before. So anyway, so it's kind of a fast ending. The whole thing kind of cuts off. It's just, you know, mm-hmm. Here are the ants. These are all the ants that are left. Now they're dead, but we don't know what else radiation can do to things, so there might be some more weird shit in the future. And there was. The 50s and 60s were full of weird radiation-affected insects and animals, and I guess even up into the 70s, too, if you count, like, the There's No Ozone Layer Anymore movies.
Yeah, and then it turned into zombies.
Yeah, exactly. We went from that to that to zombies. So anyway, that's shit. I can't talk anymore. Well, show's over, kids. So, Brian, are you afraid of ants in real life?
No. I don't like them, but I don't wage a jihad against them or anything like that. I do not know the smell of ant massacres.
You're not killing them and then smelling their death on your fingers. Yeah.
See, when I think brood odor, I think Cronenberg, and that's probably worse than ants, really.
Yeah, that odor would be far worse.
Yeah.
That would be way different.
Do you have fire ants in Michigan?
I do not believe so, no.
Really? Wow.
I bet it's too fucking cold up there.
Yeah, it's probably they can't survive the winters because they're pussies.
Man.
Yeah.
Well, count yourself among the blessed. Fire ants are bastards.
Oh, man. Yeah, they are.
Is there anything else that we need to discuss about them?
I got something.
Do it.
There's a bit in every one of these big bug movies that I always love. It's where the expert basically puts on a slideshow. This is before they had PowerPoint. And he basically is the whatever bug is in this movie, he's their hype man. Because he's there to tell you why their big bug is the baddest big bug ever. So he'll, you know, ants are the most efficient killers in the known kingdom. They can lift 20 times their own weight. They can solve equations, you know, and they go on. And, you know, a lot of this is scientifically factual because that's what it's supposed to. It's supposed to make you go, ooh, and ah. And just imagine if these little ants were the size of cars. So, every movie that followed, what's that?
Ants are the only creatures besides man who wage war.
Exactly.
And that's how he says it.
Slaves and...
And that's something that our stepson like commented on. He really just kind of floats in and out of the living room whenever we're in there. But he stepped in for just a few minutes last night and looked at the screen and he goes, "Boy, this movie is educational." It was like, "Yes, son, it is."
But like every movie that followed this did the same thing. The big Praying Mantis movie told you why the praying mantis is the baddest insect ever. I mean, even there's a movie with giant grasshoppers.
Beginning of the End.
They try to tell you why they're why that is the most amazing killing machine ever created by God. And I always got a kick out of that.
That's great. That's true. I didn't realize that until you said it, but yeah, there's always that, let me explain what we're up against.
Yes.
For I am the expert. I guess I have one final question about the film that I'll throw out to you guys. What would a movie about giant uncles be called?
The Bad Touch.
There you have it.
Oh, that's a win. All right. We will be right back with Act 3 of The Food Chain right after this.
Black Anise Horror Podcast. The podcast that will change your life forever.
Repetition of the repetition. Is that a word? That is now a word.
Intense.
Zero whatevers.
So insightful that you will question your place in the universe.
You just said you wanted to see somebody stab a fish.
Mind-blowing.
That is not what... That's not... No.
Inspiring.
It's one of two things all the way through. Either predictable or stupid.
Life-changing.
This is going to be filled with spoilers.
Black Anise Horror Podcast. Exclusively available on the Legion Podcast Network.
It's almost like a little advertisement.
Yeah, the advert makes it sound so promising.
Ryan Sammons, thank you for being on the show, sir, as our guinea pig for our first episode. Please tell our listeners where they can find you and what you're up to now.
Oh, well, first, thanks for having me. I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, so it was great to have a reason to go back and give it another watch. As for me, you can hear me rattle on about more stuff on the ABCs of Hidden Horror Podcast, on Evil Episodes Podcast, and maybe one day we'll actually go back to doing the Dark Regions Radio. It's a literary podcast that Jamie and I do. Haven't done one of those in a long time, but hey, never say never.
Fun. Well, cool.
Well, you can always find Cootie and myself on Kiss the Goat, our other podcast, which is about devil movies from the last 50 years. Devil movies, cooking, exorcisms.
Drinking.
It's just, that show has a lot of things in it. anyway, but that's on Legion Podcast. You can also hear me on the Theme Warriors Podcast and on the Cinema Beef Podcast. And of course, I have Fiction for Sale. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm just a whore. I'm everywhere. I guess that's pretty much it.
That's it, guys. Thanks for listening. Join us next time when we'll give The Will of Mutation another spin. Until then, on behalf of X and myself, we'll see you at the bottom of the food chain.